Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's speech today in Michigan, where the Republican governor is about to sign a bill to make Michigan the 24th right-to-work state, prompting the President to remark that the bill amounts to the right to work for less. Zach Pohl, the Executive Director of Progress Michigan, joins us to discuss how and why the Republicans are making gains in a state that voted overwhelmingly Democrat in the last election. Then we'll examine the latest indication that Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez is gravely ill, forcing him to name his foreign minister as a successor. Javier Corrales, the professor of political science at Amherst College, joins us. He's the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. We will discuss Venezuela's foreign policy that is unpopular at home for its support of Gaddafi, Ahmadinejad, and the Assad regime in Syria. Then finally, we'll examine the award of the Nobel Peace Prize to the European Union and speak with Stephen Hill, the author of Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure World. We'll discuss how, in spite of a faltering economy, most Europeans enjoy a higher standard of living and quality of life than their American counterparts, whose very limited social safety net is likely to be cut soon in the name of reducing the deficit to avoid the fiscal cliff. And joining us now is Zach Pohl, who's the Executive Director of Progress Michigan, a citizens watchdog group working to hold public officials accountable. Previously, he worked as Communications Director for We Are the People, a statewide coalition of students, seniors, and workers advocating for Michigan's middle class. And he also served as Press Secretary and Communications Director for former U.S. Representative Mark Schauer, Democrat of Michigan, from 2008 to 2010. Welcome to Background Briefing, Zach Pohl.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And the president gave a speech at Daimler's Detroit Diesel Division in Redford, Michigan today, where he talked, of course, about the so-called fiscal cliff negotiations going on, which, of course, made most of the headlines. However, he did talk about the efforts on the part of the Michigan legislature and its Republican governor, Rick Snyder, to make Michigan a right-to-work state. The president said the so-called right-to-work laws do not have anything to do with economics. They have to do with politics. And in effect, the right-to-work laws are about the right to work for less money. Is this going to deter the governor to sign this bill?
I sure hope so, but I'm not holding my breath. It's pretty clear that Governor Snyder and Republicans here in Lansing are dead set on passing this so-called right-to-work legislation. The question is how soon? Right now it looks like a vote will probably take place tomorrow. But the bottom line is activists on the ground here are mobilizing for a pretty big rally at the state capitol tomorrow to send a message loud and clear to politicians in Lansing that we think right-to-work is wrong for Michigan.
But it looks like the Democrats and the political left and the unions got caught by surprise because they've rammed this bill through this week, going through both legislative chambers in less than a day. And what is there to assume that the governor will not sign it? I know that the Michigan's congressional delegation met with him and weighed in. What do you know about that meeting?
Well, I know that the delegation strongly urged the governor to reconsider his position on right to work. What's been frustrating is that Governor Snyder has frankly been all over the map on this issue. When he was a candidate for the Republican nomination in 2010, he point blank said that he would sign a right to work bill if it hit his desk. However, he spent the last 2 years telling everyone that it's not on his agenda. He thinks it's divisive and that he didn't want to see a bill on his desk. That changed last week when he came out of a press conference and announced that he now was supporting right-to-work legislation. And I think maybe what caught people most by surprise was not that he suddenly supported it, but the speed and the tactics that were used to pass this. The bill was introduced just shortly after a press conference last Thursday, and a vote was taking place on the House floor in a matter of hours. And maybe most troubling was the Capitol doors were locked. As soon as this debate started happening on the floor, there wasn't a committee hearing, but people were locked out of the building. We were told by the state police it was because the building was at capacity. In reality, it was nowhere near full. It was really just a way to keep activists outside of the building, I think most likely because the governor was afraid of Michigan turning into another Wisconsin like we saw in 2011.
But this is a governor who outspent his Democratic opponents in 2010. He rode in on the Tea Party wave. That was a midterm election victory that the Republicans had in various states, largely engineered by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and Karl Rove, largely funded by the American Petroleum Institute. It shouldn't have caught anybody by surprise that this guy was a Tea Party guy.
Well, you know, as I said, Governor Snyder sort of tried to have it both ways. He's tried very hard to come across as more of a moderate than his counterparts in Wisconsin with Governor Walker and Ohio with Governor Kasich. In reality, he's been just as aggressive on labor issues as Kasich and Walker. He passed this so-called emergency manager law in 2011, which gives appointees by the governor's office the ability to come in to local communities and local school districts, tear up union contracts, fire local workers, and basically strip all power from local elected officials. He's sort of been able to fly under the radar compared to Walker and Kasich because he has this persona of being, you know, sort of a nice guy. You know, he calls himself a nerd. In reality, he's been just as aggressive in passing what's a pretty blatant power grab on the part of corporate special interests here in Michigan.
Again, I'm speaking with Zach Pohl, who's the Executive Director of Progress Michigan, a citizens watchdog group working to hold public officials accountable. Previously, he worked as Communications Director for We Are the People, a statewide coalition of students, seniors, and workers advocating for Michigan's middle class. And the right to work law that Michigan is poised to pass would make Michigan the 24th state in the United States to have a right to work law. And again, as I mentioned, in the 2010 elections, Kasich came in to Ohio and aggressively moved in that direction. Most recently, Indiana signed the law. Similar anti-union laws, of course, were passed in Wisconsin, resulting in quite a bit of pushback there. But nevertheless, Governor Scott Walker prevailed. You mentioned, Zach, that the unions and the nurses, I believe, are going to show up at the state capitol with duct tape over their mouths. There's going to be quite a lot of a backlash. But, you know, the barn door's open and the horse is down the paddock. What can you do?
Well, I think, you know, politicians are going to do what they're going to do. They're either going to pass this bill or not. Right now, it certainly looks that they will be passing this bill potentially as soon as tomorrow. I think what comes next is how elected officials get held accountable. We saw over the weekend here some local actions in Senate districts, including one in the Kalamazoo area where people went dressed as elves and Santa's helpers and delivered coal to one Republican state senator, Tanya Shootmaker. You're going to see other small rallies, protests, some town hall meetings in legislative districts across the state over the next 2 years. I think you're going to see organized labor, middle-class families coming together in a way you haven't seen before. To really hold elected officials accountable here for this vote, pushing this through at the 11th hour during the lame duck session.
So will this involve recalls like we had in Wisconsin?
You know, I don't think anyone's taken anything off the table at this point. Back in 2011, State Representative Paul Scott was recalled from office for pushing a pretty aggressive anti-union agenda. He was actually the first lawmaker to be recalled in the state of Michigan since 1983. I think it's certainly possible that we may see something like that. It's still an open question at this point. If there were to be recalls, the first likely target would be in the state Senate, because under the Constitution, you can't recall anyone following an election for a period of 6 months. And since we didn't have state Senate elections this year, state senators would be the first target. So it's certainly something I think it's on the table at this point. But the bottom line is you're going to see citizens across the state holding politicians' feet to the fire for this vote.
Well, of course, Michigan is the birthplace of the modern labor movement. So this strikes a lot of people as being a real poke in the eye for the labor movement in this country, which is obviously diminished in influence over the decades, down to about 6% of the private workforce. You've also, in accompanying this sort of stealth passage of this right-to-work law in Michigan by the Republicans in both legislatures, and the government's poised to sign it, this has been accompanied by a $1 million television and radio campaign put forth by the Michigan Freedom Fund, along with Americans for Prosperity, the billionaire Koch brothers organization. They've been producing pamphlets and distributing them throughout Lansing and throughout Michigan. So the right wing are hitting the ground running. They're organized. This is, I guess, a victory for them.
You know, unfortunately, it seems to be that way, at least right now in the short term. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that this this pretty aggressive power grab has been in the works for quite some time. Interestingly, just today, the state Democratic Party here in Michigan released a video of the former Republican Party chairman here in Michigan talking about the fact that this is something that's been in the works since 2007. They've been conducting extensive polling research, focus groups. At one point, they even considered putting their own amendment to the state constitution on the ballot. But that ultimately, they made the decision to wait to push right-to-work legislation until they had a Republican governor. And so now, here we are in the lame duck session following the 2012 elections. Governor Snyder and the Republican legislature are poised to pass this bill. Clearly something that's been in the works for some time. I don't think it should come as a surprise to anyone, but I think the next steps are going to be, as I said, you know, making sure that the public is fully aware of how this is going to hurt Michigan's middle class and holding these elected officials accountable back in their home districts.
But Zach Pohl, this looks like a part of the 2010 Rove plan, in effect, where you put in a Tea Party governor, as they did in Ohio and in Wisconsin, and you push through all of this model legislation created by ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which, by the way, 60 Minutes did an expose on Sunday, to the extent that the mainstream press is waking up to ALEC, which has been operating for some time. This governor's been around since 2010. It seems as though, when you say it's a lame duck session, what does that mean? Is he going out of office?
Governor Snyder's not, but the state legislature, you know, we just had the election, and so in the state house, Democrats picked up 5 seats, so there will Republicans will have a much narrower majority next year. And in fact, with the margin that they had to pass right to work last Thursday, it's clear that if they had waited until 2013, they wouldn't have the votes to pass this in the state house. So that seems to be the reason for pushing this right now, because it seems otherwise they wouldn't have the votes to pass this through the state house.
But does that mean that there's a possibility on that the new Democratic legislature would be able to overturn it?
Unfortunately, it doesn't seem that way. You know, Democrats have moved closer to taking the majority, but Republicans will still have control next year. So, you know, Democrats won't be able to overturn this. Now, there is the possibility that people could put a measure on the ballot in 2014 to essentially pass what's called a Citizens Initiative, which would effectively enact new legislation to overturn right-to-work bill. That's certainly something that's been put out on the table as a possibility, and I think it's something we may see develop over the coming months.
Again, I'm speaking with Zach Pohl, who's Executive Director of Progress Michigan, a Citizens Watchdog Group, working to hold public officials accountable. Previously, he worked as Communications Director for We Are the People, a statewide coalition of students, seniors, and workers advocating for Michigan's middle class. Now, these right-to-work laws that ALEC have pushed along with other anti-labor and right-wing initiatives, including the Stand Your Ground law that came to people's attention with the shooting down in Florida of Trayvon Martin, clearly they indicate the power of money versus the power of people. Now, it sounds like the people are getting organized in Michigan, even though it's too late to stop this bill. But just to address the bills themselves, these right to work, and of course the right to work has been in the South for some time, and it's pretty clear, isn't it, that the real motive behind passing these right to work laws are that they will defund unions, because it means that union members can get the benefits of what the unions have forced employers to give their workers, but they don't have to pay their dues. So isn't that the heart of this bill?
Oh, you're absolutely right, Ian. Basically, this would make it illegal for employers and employees to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement that requires all workers in that workplace to contribute their fair share towards the cost of negotiating and enforcing that collective bargaining agreement. Under current law, nobody's actually forced to join a union. People can, if they choose not to join the union, pay what's called an agency fee, which covers their share of that collective bargaining agreement. Right to work would essentially allow some workers in a union workplace to enjoy the benefits of union wages and benefits without contributing anything in dues or agency fees. It actually, supporters of Right to Work have started calling it freedom to work. In reality, it's the freedom to freeload. As I said, it would allow some workers to benefit from union wages and benefits without contributing towards that collective bargaining agreement. It's fundamentally unfair, and as you said, is all about weakening unions because, let's face it, corporations, CEOs like the Koch brothers know that unions are one of the few remaining checks on corporate power. Unions are one of the few institutions that are, stopping CEOs from shipping more American jobs overseas to countries like China. And so, Right to Work legislation, again, is really just a power grab for CEOs to continue to undermine union power. And we know that it's ultimately going to weaken the middle class here in Michigan.
Well, just in closing, Zach Pohl, I find this whole thing quite disturbing and quite surprising, given what the American people have stated, if you will, through this most recent election. We have a president who was outspent massively by the Republicans, who nevertheless won a popular vote victory that's much greater than any of the recent presidents, including Ronald Reagan. The final count was about 5 million ahead in the popular vote. And of course, he trounced Romney in the Electoral College. He also won Michigan. The Democrats won more votes in the House, even though the Republicans control it because of Republican gerrymandering. So just to, step back a bit and look at the broad political landscape, the American people spoke pretty clearly that they are on the side of working and middle-class Americans. And yet here you have this incredible attack on the working and Americans in the middle class by the Republican legislature in Michigan.
You're absolutely right, Ian. Yeah, Democrats here, voted to reelect President Obama in Michigan. Senator Debbie Stabenow won with a pretty astounding 20-point margin. Democrats, as you said, got more votes collectively across the state for state house candidates than Republicans, and yet we will have the minority next year. And that just speaks to the influence of corporate money in elections, the influence of special interests in the redistricting process. It's sad, and it's I think ultimately a sad reflection on our democracy that this is happening right now here in Michigan. But the bottom line is people are going to continue to fight this fight. People are mobilizing as we speak to come to the Capitol tomorrow to make their voices heard. And while we may not stop this legislation from passing tomorrow, this fight's only going to continue, and people are going to continue to speak up and fight for the middle class here in Michigan. And I certainly don't anticipate that stopping anytime soon.
Well, Zach Pohl, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Zach Pohl, who's the Executive Director of Progress Michigan, a citizens watchdog group working to hold public officials accountable. Previously, he worked as Communications Director for We Are the People, a statewide coalition of students, seniors, and workers advocating for Michigan's middle class, and he also served as Press Secretary and Communications Director for former U.S. Representative Mark Shea, Democrat of Michigan from 2008 to 2010. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Hugo Chavez's health and his choice of a successor.
If the lakes took the place of the sea, if the cars drove themselves way to be, opposite to the trains moving in, rivers run interstate Michigan.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Javier Carreras, who is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. And he serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly. He has been a consultant to the United Nations Center for Global Development and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His latest book is U.S.-Venezuelan Relations Since the 1990s, Coping with Mid-Level Security Threats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Javier Carreras.
Thank you very much.
And you're quoted extensively in the New York Times on Monday about Venezuela President Hugo Chavez's latest trip to Cuba for more cancer surgery. And the fact that he has actually appointed a successor is really, I guess, that's news. There's been so much uncertainty and so many speculation about Chavez's mortality, if you will. And a lot of the speculation has been on there's never been any sort of succession in place, which has concerned a lot of people. But now there appears to be succession. So what do you make of it?
You're absolutely right. The reason that this is newsworthy is because Chavez has been a president who's been undergoing treatment for cancer, and his health hasn't been getting any better. But all along this time, he has refused to address the possibility of succession. And so what he has done is he interrupted treatment in Cuba. He flew back home to Venezuela, and in a matter of 24 hours, made the public announcement that he has finally decided on his successor. He was, of course, speaking mostly to his own party, where enormous uncertainty, and more than just uncertainty, but internal competition for the job was getting a little bit out of control. And so he went back home, in my opinion, to settle that debate and to finally tell the Chavistas that Maduro is Chavez's choice.
And Maduro is the a former bus driver union official. He's the foreign minister. He's a relatively young guy, isn't he?
He is young, and he is he comes from a labor background, and he's not a person who comes from an elite world by any stretch of the imagination. He has done very well. But it is important to juxtapose his humble background to the kind of job that he has had under Chavez. He is Chavez's foreign minister, has been since 2006. And one of the things that occurs is, as happens with all foreign ministers, you end up surrounding yourself with foreign dignitaries who are, number one, not Venezuelan, and number two, mostly elites. So he has this problem now that in many ways he has a humble background, which is in line with what the image that the revolution wants to convey, but he has been a diplomat, the top diplomat for the country, and that has separated him a little bit from the Venezuelan ordinary citizenry.
Well, my understanding, though, is that Chavez's foreign policy is not entirely popular back home in Venezuela. His support, for example, for the Assad dictatorship in Syria, which he's helping keep alive by supplying them with oil and diesel because they're undergoing an international boycott, that's very unpopular, I believe, with the Syrian diaspora. There's a considerable Syrian and Lebanese diaspora in Venezuela, and they've been demonstrating against Hugo Chavez's foreign policy. So this new nominee or successor of Chavez, if indeed he has terminal cancer, which seems to be the consensus of opinion in the intelligence world, is Maduro going to be stuck with an unpopular foreign policy?
The foreign policy, both or especially these relations with what we in the United States would call rogue states or pariah states, this foreign policy is very unpopular across this entire electorate, but not that unpopular within the hardcore Chavista. So you're right that the foreign policy is unpopular, but not in the group that matters at this point. At this point, what matters is to make sure that the Chavistas are happy with the choice. So this aspect of Maduro is not going to be upsetting to Chavistas. The opposition and the folks who are not Chavistas will focus on something else. We'll focus on another aspect of Maduro, and that is whether Maduro has a more conciliatory approach toward the opposition. They're going to be like, we can discount the foreign policy. We know that he needed to have this type of radical foreign policy because that is his job as foreign minister. We don't know how he's going to behave on the question of government-opposition relations. And the opposition at the moment is a little bit more hopeful, or they're a little bit hopeful that Maduro will be less radical and intransigent when in dealing with non-Chavistas at home.
So within the constituency of Hugo Chavez, the Bolivarian circles, as he calls them, he's obviously incredibly popular. He has been president for 14 years and just won a new six-year term very handily. So there's no doubting his popularity. But you were suggesting that across the board, his foreign policy is not particularly popular.
That is correct, that in general, the popularity of Chavez is not based on his foreign policy.
So what is the popular opinion then? For example, Chavez supported Gaddafi towards the end.
That's right.
Along revolutionary principles, but this was a multi-billionaire kleptocrat whose miserable, vicious young sons drove around in Ferraris and murdered everybody that they didn't like. I mean, where's the revolutionary credentials of Gaddafi? And the Assads are a family of kleptocrats who have brutally controlled Syria as a family plantation for over 40 years through their ruthless and secret police, the Muhabarat. So I don't understand the revolutionary credentials here of the people that Chavez supports.
When the question is cast in terms of, are these regimes that Chavez supports good for the people at home? Is it a question of, are they fighting for democracy and the little guys? The answer is, of course, for anybody who is revolutionary, is of course not. But when they cast the question in terms of fighting the West, these regimes suddenly become valuable to a particular type of leftist in Latin America for whom anti-imperialism is the ultimate goal. So what they see revolutionary about these regimes is the fact that they are fighting against pressures from outside, and especially pressures from Europe and the United States and international organizations. That is what gives them a sense of revolutionary link with these folks. It's hard for us to understand that. It's hard for me to understand that, but they view revolution as both a global as well as an internal struggle. And for the Chavistas, the hardcore Chavistas, these regimes that we would consider pariahs are defensible because they are, quote-unquote, anti-imperialist.
Again, I'm speaking with Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College. She's the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. And his latest book is U.S.-Venezuelan Relations Since the 1990s, Coping with Mid-Level Security Threats. So if indeed Chavez has cancer, which of course he does have cancer, apparently the initial diagnosis indicated that it had spread into his pelvis, and it sounds like with the operations that he's already had, this will be his fourth operation in 18 months, the one that he's just undergoing now in Cuba. And he's also had both chemotherapy and radiation treatment, and I don't think the prognosis is particularly good. What is the succession process here? Because he's due to begin a new six-year term in office on the 10th of January, and the Constitution states that should the president leave office in the first 4 years of his terms, then an election must be held within 30 days. So assuming that Chavez is not going to live particularly long, months or so, whatever, and of course this is all speculation, but let's assume that that is the case. Will this new president-elect or the presidential nominee, successor, if you will, Nicolas Maduro, will he have to face an election?
Yes. There is no question, and Chavez spoke about this, that the successor will have to face a presidential election. And he has said Chavez's anointment of Nicolas Maduro was he is the one who has to run for office when that election comes. The difficulty is that the Constitution says the following. If the president leaves office, abandons office, is absent from office before he becomes the official president on the 10th of January. He's now president. He's president in office, but also president-elect. So if it happens now, power is transferred to not Nicolás Maduro, who is the vice president, but to the president of the legislature, the National Assembly. If Chávez abandons power, is absent from his office after the 10th of January, then power is transferred to Nicolás Maduro. But the issue here is that Chávez has said, regardless of whether power is transferred to the National Assembly president or to the vice president, this is an interim issue. Both of them are going to have to call for an election, and the candidate of the PSUV party, regardless of the interim president, will be Maduro.
Well, it seems, though, that already the Chavistas are targeting the person who ran against and lost to Chavez, Capriles. He's running for a state governor's seat, he's having a difficult race, is he not, as governor of Miranda province. And it looks as though they're already looking ahead to knock him off so that he doesn't have a second shot.
You're right. When news came out that Chávez was sick, one of the decisions that they made was to split the general election between a presidential election, which took place in October, and now a regional election for governors, which is going to take place this weekend in Venezuela. In the presidential election, Chávez beat Capriles, the leader of the opposition, and what Capriles decided at that point is to say, well, I'm going to run for the state of Miranda, my home state, where I used to be governor. And you're absolutely right. The most significant energy is being channeled by the Chavistas to prevent a victory by Capriles in his home state. They're focusing on two states. One is Miranda, Capriles' home state, and the other one is the state of Zulia, a major oil-producing region, which has always been under the control of anti-Chavistas forces. So the Chavistas want those two states, and they are investing all the resources that they can, and in large amounts, incredibly large amounts of money, into those two races. So we will see. Capriles continues to be the favorite, but it's going to be a tight race, and it wouldn't be unthinkable for the Chavistas to defeat Capriles, although most polls still place Capriles ahead in his own home state of Miranda.
Well, I recall speaking to some reporters down there in Venezuela before the elections about Capriles, and he wasn't the greatest candidate. He doesn't have the people skills and the charisma that Chavez has. Has he gotten any better? I mean, has he learned something from this defeat for president?
I think that he has. I think that he started out with that reputation exactly, in fact, that profile. But over the course of a year and a half of campaigning, he became a more impressive figure, earned the respect of all sectors of the opposition, which is very diverse ideologically and strategically, very diverse in terms of how they think. So he was able to maintain unity and expand the absolute numbers of voters who side with the opposition. So as a candidate, he surpassed expectations, absolutely. A very different man from the one we knew 2 years ago. And that is why many people in the opposition continue to think of him as the natural leader of the opposition, even if he lost to Chávez in October.
But he'd be running against, assuming he gets the mantle, he'll be running against an authentic working-class guy in the form of Maduro, right? And how much is Capriles tainted with the old guard regime?
He's not tainted with the old regime. He's way younger. He began his political career under Chavismo. He doesn't have links with old parties. The government has tried to make that argument that he is part of the ancien regime, the oligarchy. That hasn't really worked ever. Capriles was governor, and as governor, he was immensely popular. That's how he rose to prominence. Unlike Maduro, He has traveled throughout the country. He has visited. His campaign for the presidency took him to more than 55 cities in the country, and he really beat Chavez in terms of contacting the folks. Yes, Maduro has a more revolutionary background, has a more humble background, has a working class background, but as I was saying, for the past 6 years, Maduro has been a diplomat and away from electoral politics in Venezuela, never competing for office. And so we're not sure whether Maduro has electoral appeal.
Well,
Chavez does have electoral appeal.
I see. So just in closing then, Javier Corrales, the big issue, in my understanding, in the last election was personal security and safety. Venezuela is one of the most crime-ridden countries in the world, if not in the hemisphere. And there's a lot of insecurity about crime, and Chavez is more ideological than he is practical as far as crime's concerned. It's not an issue that he's really wanted to address. So where does that stand?
Yes, it's important to know the facts. There's no question that Venezuela is a champion in world crime. It has some of the highest homicide rates, close to 68 homicides per 100,000 inhabitants. This is a figure that is greater than you would expect even in war-torn countries. And this level of murders, this degree of criminality, is different. It's not the result of the state trying to fight it. In Mexico, for example, you see an increase in criminality because the state at one point decided to go after some of these criminal gangs. In Venezuela, that's not the case. In Venezuela, the excessive rates of criminality are the result of the state not doing much about it and creating a sense of impunity where your chances of getting in trouble by being a criminal are very small, and so this has produced this expansion of crime. Everybody now at this point is wondering how much longer the state is going to be able to tolerate what, under any other circumstance, would be an incredibly chaotic world to be in. Any Venezuelan city, you are so exposed to any type of crime, from the smallest to the most brutal. And everybody continues to be surprised that Chavez remains somewhat cavalier about this. I don't think we're going to see a major policy initiative on the part of Chavistas if they continue to stay in office on the question of crime, which unfortunately is definitely out of control in the country.
But what's just in closing, though, what's he thinking? I mean, why does he tolerate so much crime and insecurity amongst his own people? Is it because the targets of the crime are the people that he hates, the wealthy and
no,
the middle class?
It's not that. A lot of the crime is occurring among the urban poor, folks who used to vote for Chavez in great numbers. They still vote for Chavez, but not in the same numbers. So a lot of the crime is targeting the poorest neighborhoods as well as low-income neighborhoods. I think the reason is that you have to understand that Venezuela is a petrostate. That means that all the sources of revenue for the government, or the majority of revenues, come from oil. So when you have a high crime situation, that will hurt business and the private sector activities. A state that relies on taxing the private sector will have an incentive to then provide order for the private sector to operate. But in Venezuela, where 50% of the revenues come from the oil sector, you can afford as a state to have a lot of crime with declining business activity and even capital drain because you still have oil enough. So what you see is you don't have the normal mechanism through which states feel compelled to act, which is the private sector saying, we're sinking, we can't operate, there is too much disorder, we're living in a no man's land. So I think part of the answer is that oil in this case is precluding the government or exempting the government from feeling the urgency to do something about crime.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Javier Corrales.
Great. It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Javier Corrales, who is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela. And he serves on the editorial board of Latin American Politics and Society and America's Quarterly. He's been a consultant to the United Nations Center for Global Development and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And his latest book is U.S.-Venezuelan Relations Since the 1990s, Coping with Mid-Level Security Threats. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the European Union's Nobel Prize, not for economics, but for peace.
I love Paris in the springtime. I love Paris in the
choices here across. As children grow, they grow with what they see. And in these times where paranoia closes in, power and hate are rampaging disease. In our minds we build the blocks to what we need. In our minds we're reaching out for peace. And in our hearts we know of such the hills to climb. In our hearts a sense of master feed.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Hill, who's a writer, columnist, and political professional. He's the former director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation, and his books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts. His latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Hill.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
And Europe, of course, or the European Union, has just received the Nobel Peace Prize. I suppose you could make a joke and say, well, at least they didn't receive the Nobel Economics Prize. To tell me, what is it about this Peace Prize that Europe has gotten, particularly in the context of what has been a two-year-long agony in terms of the euro crisis?
Well, like you say, this is not an economics prize. This is a peace prize. And if you look at it from that point of view, and you think about the history of the world in the last 100 years where and the centuries before that, where Europe fought war after war after war, France against the UK, against Germany, against Spain. I mean, you know, this is a place that has fought the bloodiest of wars. And compared to those times, Europe is a remarkably peaceful place. So you have to look at it from that perspective. I mean, you know, the Nobel Committee does have a history of surprising recipients, including Henry Kissinger, Barack Obama, who had barely been in office a couple of months. And sometimes they seem to give the prize based on their hopes and their aspirations, not necessarily on achievements. But in this case, I think it's totally well-founded. The Union has certainly done a huge amount to spread peace, not only on the European continent, but in its near abroad, Turkey. I mean, you know, Turkey used to be a place routinely condemned by Amnesty International as a military dictatorship. Today it's a secular Islamic democracy, and much of that is because of the incentives that Europe offered to Turkey to join the European Union at some point. So I think there's many, many ways you can look at this and realize that this is a fitting and proper use of the Nobel Peace Prize.
So I guess this is a case of giving an award to the European Union for the fact that they've been at peace for decades, as opposed to giving it to somebody that's trying to stop wars today in the war-torn part of the world. You just mentioned the Middle East. Now, it's true that maybe in several decades from now, who knows? I mean, in many ways, I just was speaking to somebody yesterday who said, an Egyptian-born New York Times veteran reporter, who said that he was surprised in terms of the downturn in Egypt and in terms of its Arab Spring democratic potential. with this reversal by Morsi and the power grab and the street demonstrations. He said the one thing that gave him hope was that there are a lot of liberals and secularists out there fighting against this Islamic takeover. So what about the idea, though, of giving it to somebody from these parts of the world that are fighting the good fight now, not celebrating, you know, the last of the wars that ended in 1945?
Well, I don't know what the philosophy is of the Nobel Committee when they pick these things. I mean, certainly they give one every year, so maybe that will be the recipient this year. I mean, sometimes they give it to noted individuals and not someone who we've heard of for the sometimes grassroots work they've been doing. Other times they give it to, you know, world-famous figures. And they don't often give it to organizations. But I think, particularly when you think about the challenges that the world is facing today, including the economic challenges, but also the ecological challenges, global climate change, I mean, no place on planet Earth has done more to try and rein in their carbon emissions and to create an economy that's sustainable than Europe has. And so, and as I mentioned earlier, the political union that they've got and how it's put to rest centuries of war is, again, a model for other places around the world. Their current economic challenges are, that's a longer conversation, but it's really not a product of that the European economies aren't working as much as that Europe is in the process of deciding, do they want to become, in the next stage of their evolution, a United States of Europe? Do they want to pool their budgets, and do they want to pool their banks and their tax revenues in the way that we do here in the United States of America? That's a huge decision that's going to take many years, not only to make that decision, but then to put the institutions in place that facilitate that decision. And so you have to separate out the current economic challenges that Europe is going through with the political victories they've already won, their leadership they're showing on ecological issues, sustainability issues, and these sorts of things. And you know, there is no perfect in this world. Every place has its challenges. No place is doing it 100% right. But when you look at all the other regions of the world, including here in the United States, even today, Europe is doing many, many things right. And places like Sweden, Germany, many, many of the member states in the European Union are, in fact, they're the progressive dream. I mean, everything that progressives want, universal health care, better policies for retirement, all these sorts of things, they already have that. And that's what we're fighting for here in the United States. So there's much you can point to at Europe, despite the headlines that we're seeing out day after day, that many of them, I think, are somewhat propagandistic. That, you know, there are many conservatives in this country that don't want Americans to look at Europe as a model. So they have a vested interest in just keeping the problems that Europe's having right now constantly in the headlines.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Hill, who is a writer, columnist, and political professional. He's the former director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation, and his latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure World. And there's no question the difference between the standard of living in these European social democracies and the United States is stark. And everything that we can only dream of here in the United States is taken for granted, like full health care coverage, pregnancy leaves, 6 weeks vacation. You mentioned how Europe has taken the lead in carbon reductions to the only, along with Australia, the only people that came out of the Doha round of the Kyoto Protocols, which were extended in 2020, and only Europe and Australia are sticking to the greenhouse gas reduction targets. So there's many things, and it's true, I think, that we are propagandized here in the United States to believe that not only is Europe dying under socialism, but so is our Canadians to the north of us here are suffering under free health care, etc. It is monstrous and venal propaganda when you consider what these countries provide for their citizens in spite of their shaky economy at the moment. compared to what's happening in this country, where what little we have in terms of a social safety net is under attack from the Republicans and from the deficit hawks. So,
I just wrote an article that's supposed to come out at theatlantic.com sometime this week about how we here in the United States could double the Social Security payout. And we could do that really simply by, you know, making everybody pay the same amount, the same percentage, because right now people who make above $108,000 don't pay any more into the Social Security fund. And then a lot of businesses that provide pensions for their employees, they get to get a big whopping deduction from the federal government for providing that pension, even though the employees are paying into that to get the pension as well. But if we double the Social Security payout, that businesses don't need to provide pensions anymore. So just by making those two changes, we would raise about two-thirds of the revenue needed to double the Social Security payout. And, you know, other places in Europe are already doing this. And so, you know, when we read about that somehow Europe is falling apart, it's having some challenges, and certain member states like Greece, certainly Spain and others more than the other ones. And they're in the process, and it's going to take years to figuring out of how to, you know, to perfect a union to a United States of Europe. But you can't compare that to what we have here in the United States, where we have so much wealth, and yet it is not distributed fairly. It is not distributed broadly. The average American is pumping twice as much carbon into the environment as the average European. And our cars use far more fuel than the Europeans or Japanese or anyone. So, you know, President Obama isn't doing nearly enough in so many ways to push the Congress to enact the policies that we need in this country, in my view. So, you know, going back to the original subject, Nobel Peace Prize for Europe. Sure, I think it's fitting. Europe is providing a model for the world. Europe is not perfect. It has its challenges, but no place is. And I think we have a lot to learn from them.
And Stephen Hill, in terms of your book, Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age, has Europe's economic problems essentially made it impossible for the debate to take place in this country in order to make the American people recognize how much worse off they are than the average European in terms of the quality of their life, in terms of the government services? I mean, it seems to me at the heart of the problem here in the United States compared to the Europeans is that Europeans vote for politicians who deliver social services. They have a pretty simple formula. We pay our taxes and we expect government services in return. And they get extraordinarily good government services, but they do pay more taxes. Here we pay, we are taxed among the lowest in the world. But we also have the worst government services and the least government services. But we have an enormous amount of right-wing welfare, like the defense budget, agribusiness, etc. And it seems to me that this simple notion, this practical notion of you vote for people who deliver services, is not in our political DNA. We vote for people based upon things like abortion, for God's sake, that have nothing to do with politics.
Well, 2 points. First, it's somewhat of a myth that that Europeans pay more in taxes than we do here in the United States, because if you look at, for example, Americans, we're paying twice as much money per capita for health care. We're paying a lot more out of pocket to get things like daycare. University students are paying far more money for university education, for tuition, than they are in Europe. And I can list a whole host of things in which Americans are paying far more out of pocket to get the same services that Europeans are getting in exchange for their taxes. And so if you just look at it through the narrow lens of taxes, then yeah, it looks like Europeans pay more. But really, what difference does it make which pocket it comes out of? Is it come out of taxes or come out of your out-of-pocket expenses, your discretionary income? Either way, you're paying. And when you add up the whole ball of wax up and, you know, both sides of the ledger, what you're paying for what you get, you discover that Americans are paying far, at least as much as Europeans are, but we're getting far less for our money. And that comes down to your other point, which is the politics. And that's really where, if you don't have politics that rein in your economics, you're really going to be in trouble. And that's what we have in the United States, a problem where, you know, we've had a long-standing political collapse before we had the economic collapse. That's why the average American's wages haven't gone up for a couple of decades. And there are real reasons for that. It's because we don't have things like public financing of campaigns, free media time for candidates. We don't have proportional representation, which creates multi-party democracy, which gives voters more choice, so you're not taken for granted by the Democrats or Republicans because now voters have other choices out there. We don't have universal automatic voter registration. Instead, we have about 25% to 30% of Americans who are eligible to vote but aren't even registered to vote. The voter turnout we just had in the presidential election was lower in this year than it was in 2004 when John Kerry ran against George W. Bush. We don't have a good, robust public broadcasting sector. I mean, if it wasn't for KPFK and other Pacifica stations, we would really have hardly any inquiring media at all in the United States. But in Europe, they have, you know, public broadcasting gets $40, $50 per capita. Here in the United States, public broadcasting gets $3 per capita. They have public finance of campaigns. They have free media time. They have universal voter registration. In short, they have a more robust democracy that not only creates multi-party representation in the legislatures, but that also produces more debate of issues. If you think about how the American political system works, you know, if I'm the head of the Democratic Party, I can look out there in the political landscape and I can say, okay, these districts over here, we know we're going to win those. We don't have to worry about those. These ones over here, we're never going to win. So we just focus in on about three dozen races out of 435 seats in the House of Representatives that are going to decide the majority. And so what should be a national election becomes this sliced and diced electorate of swing voters in swing states and swing congressional districts that decide our elections. And so, you know, when you do that, you lose the national discussion about what are the issues of the times. And so in so many ways, our political system is just really, really holding us back from having a full discussion of what the issues are, what the solutions might be. Whereas in Europe, they have this kind of full, robust discussion of all these issues, and that has led to better policy on things like health care, retirement, child care, parental leave, vacation, all the studies show that a well-rested workforce is a more productive workforce. And that's how Europe has been able to maintain its wealth for so many years, is because their workers are so productive. And right. Part of that is how they're treated. They're treated better. I mean, Germany has pioneered things like co-determination, where the workers get to elect 50% of the members of the boards of directors of major corporations, Fortune 500 companies. It'd be like if Walmart in the United States had to, by law, allow its workers to elect 50% of the members of its board of directors. That's what they have all across Europe. So just so many ways, Europe is really modern society 2.0. Their politics, their economics, at the member state level, not at the European-wide level, where they're still trying to figure out whether to become the United States of Europe or not. At the environmental level, all these ways, Europe is just really setting the standards that the rest of the world should be learning from.
Well, Stephen Hill, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my great pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Hill, who is a writer, columnist, and political professional. He's a former director of political reform program at the New America Foundation. His books include 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, and Whose Vote Counts. His latest book is Europe's Promise, Why the European Way is the Best Hope for an Insecure Age. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and I'll answer your questions. The conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.